And there you go, a delightful slide of Paul's face. The next hour.
Okay.
Just so, to look at this again.
Yeah. So we're on, yeah? So, okay, so my, for the tape, my name's Paul Kearney. I don't know what to do. I don't know if, I don't know who to speak to here. I've got a swivelly chair, so I could do that if you want some attention. I should say, if you are looking at the picture, that was me in Florida, in Disney World. I really recommend it. Happiest time of my life, I think. Okay, so, what I'm going to talk to you about is the contribution of policy studies or policy theory to evidence-based policymaking. So I'm sort of making this argument that a lot of discussion of evidence-based policymaking, you know, in kind of media discussions or, in fact, a lot of the scientific discussion, it's not based really on a knowledge of the policy process. So it tends to produce often superficial discussions or a kind of exasperated people saying, you know, there's this huge gap between evidence and policy. And I think if we understand how the process works, we can provide a more kind of realistic set of assumptions or expectations about what will happen. So that's what we'll do today. And what I've done with the blog post is I've given you a whole bunch of links that take you on to further reading. So this is a kind of taster session to show the importance of these concepts. And then, you know, you can do two things depending on which class you're in, I guess. For me, this is a great way to explain all these concepts in more depth throughout the course. Or you can use these concepts to help explain the, you know, evidence-based process. Okay. So since we're academics, I mean, the first point I make is that it's important to define and clarify what these terms are. So I'll go into that in some depth, and I've given you a link to this other post, which is, you know, we use these phrases, evidence-based policy, evidence-based policy making, and people use those terms to complain about so-called policy-based evidence, you know, the assumption that policymakers, particularly elected policymakers, decide what they want to do and then gather evidence to support what they want to do. But I've given you, if you look at that post, I think there's at least 12 different ways in which you could say, you know, this is policy-based evidence. And, you know, from that idea that people just do what they want to this idea that they use the wrong evidence, you know, it's not scientific enough, or they go ahead of the evidence, or, you know, I think a lot of scientists complain, they give a little bit of evidence and they say, well, it will only tell you so much, and then sort of policymakers go off on one with it. Yeah, so this kind of exasperated phrase sums up a whole, you know, whole range of activity that's worth getting into in some detail. Then what I'll say is that it's important to compare initial models of policymaking with more realistic ones. So I'll talk about the policy cycle, which is what you know, my course will be talking about this afternoon. I don't know if you've covered that in yours, but I'll describe that in a little bit of depth, cycle. And this idea of the difference between comprehensive and bounded rationality. So two terms that we use to get into, you know, what really happens when policy is made. And then finally, I'll just touch on some further reading on what do you do with this information. So, you know, so for example, imagine you want to be influential within the policy process, you know, armed with this knowledge. What do you do? Now, I'll go into some of the kind of big ethical dilemmas that the academics or scientists will face if they accept this notion of policymaking that I give you. Okay. So in terms of definitions, you know, the first question that I would always start with is this question, what is policy? And then you end up saying, well, it's incredibly difficult to define. So you come up with something like, you know, the working definition I would use, you know, something like the sum total of government action from signals of intent to the final outcome. And, you know, part of that is to raise all these problems with any definition. So the first is, you know, it's problematic to conflate what people say they will do and what they actually do. And there's a big difference between what they actually do and what the outcome is. So you can define policy as, you know, the statement, the action, the outcome, and all of those things are problematic. You know, if you say policy is all of those things, you've got a problem. If you separate them out, you've got a problem because, you know, you want to say that, you know, a policy statement is policy. It's very difficult from an outcome. And if you look at an outcome, well, that doesn't just depend on what governments do. Then you would say, well, you know, if you talk about policy and policy making, it's made routinely by elected and unelected policymakers and in cooperation with actors who don't have really a formal role in that process. And then you say, well, you know, a lot of policymaking is a study about power and the power not to do something. So it ends up with, you know, policy is everything the government does and doesn't do, you know, which is everything. Okay, so you never really solve that definitional problem, but it helps you understand what we're talking about. And it's the same thing with measuring policy change. So, you know, I mean, the first problem is if you don't really know what policy is, it's hard to know how much it changed. And then it's really difficult to actually know if you should be complaining about what happens. You know, if you don't know, if you can't define what governments are doing, how much policy has changed, you know, how can you know if it's good or not? But instead, what you can do is you can identify the many kind of different kinds of policy instruments government make and come up with a sense of which are the most important decisions and how much policy has changed as a result. Okay, so now the relevance to evidence-based policymaking is that I think when you go through these definitions, you're describing the making and delivery of policy continuously. So I think a lot of the kind of superficial discussions of evidence suggest that it's a bit like a set piece event, you know, a single opportunity in which you can introduce evidence and a policymaker can accept it. So you point to instances in which that doesn't happen and you call that policy-based evidence, right? So, but I think, you know, this tends to be a much more continuous, complicated process. Now, that's particularly complicated if you just decide that, you know, that the policymakers include people who are elected and unelected, and include people within, you know, so-called policy communities who are so involved in these decisions that they help make them. And that complicates this idea of, you know, the kind of injection of evidence within that process. Now, the final definitional issue that I find most interesting is this question about what is evidence. So, I don't know, anyone can define what evidence is before we go any further? Just for the recording. Everyone was nodding, but I ignored them. It's something like it's an argument backed by information, right? You make an assertion, you back out with information, that's evidence. Then you have this distinction between evidence and scientific evidence. Now, I think that's intuitively what people really mean by evidence, produced scientifically or by scientists. So some people describe scientific very broadly, you know, including me. So, you know, so you refer to information gathered systematically using recognized methods. Nice and broad definition. But others often implicitly refer to a particular kind of scientific information based on a hierarchy of scientific methods. So particularly in areas like health science, there's a hierarchy of evidence gathering. And at the top, second from the top, is the use of the randomized controlled trial. And at the top is a systematic review of those trials. I mean, I think if you start listening to, not much fun, but you start listening to, you know, Radio 4 coverage of evidence, for example, you know, they often get on scientists to describe these reviews they've done of the evidence. And it's a particular kind of scientific evidence they're talking about. So think about how that fits into if policy is evidence-based or policy-based evidence. Some people will call it policy-based evidence if it does not draw primarily on randomized controlled trials, okay, which is almost all policy, I'd imagine. Okay, so I mean, that's a crucial wider point, that the policymakers will seek many kinds of information that many scientists would not consider to be the evidence. And I would look out for that in discussions. You know, when people talk about the evidence, what is it they're actually pointing to? You know, what's their rationale? Okay. So to sum up that first part then, you've got two key points of potential confusion when people discuss evidence-based policy making. Okay, so when you describe evidence-based policy, you need to clarify what the policy is and who's making it. And it's not just about elected politicians making announcements. You know, it's very difficult to decide if something is evidence-based, you know, at the start of the notional start of a process or announcement. Then second, when we're describing evidence, we need to clarify what counts and what an evidence-based policy response would actually look like. It's very difficult, actually, when you consider those issues, to point to something and decide if it's evidence-based. And, you know, for me, this distinction, this binary distinction between evidence-based policy and policy-based evidence, it's almost meaningless, except in a political sense. You know, people use these phrases politically to criticise the basis for policy. You know, they do it loosely. You know, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's a strategic thing to criticise policy in those terms. Okay, so, second point. I don't know, given I've got 3 points, this might only take 30 minutes. We could be out of here. We could be sitting checking our phones at 9:30. Okay, second point. Realistic models are important. So what's wrong with the policy cycle? Now, I think a traditional way to understand policy making is to compare it to an ideal type. And I guess that's some things we're used to in universities. You identify an ideal type, and then you say, well, what happens in the real world when the conditions of these ideal types are not met? So this isn't necessarily an ideal to aspire to. It's a sort of simplification, you know, an artificial construct to compare with the real world. So in this case, you would do it with two things, the policy cycle and so-called comprehensive rationality. I could waste some of your time trying to find the cycle online.
It's actually one of my earlier slides.
Oh, is it? Right. Well, yeah, but... Well, no, I like my own stuff, Peter. Come on. Let's see.
Mine was a treasury loan, that cycle as well.
Right, here we go. There you go, this counts as a PowerPoint now, right? Here comes a slide. This would be great for the listen back as well. Okay, so there's the cycle that I would be talking about. Okay, you'll recognise this now from the doors of lots of members of staff, because this is what we're using to describe your feedback and feed forward now. These, you know, replace all these stages with, you know, feedback, listen to feedback, complain about feedback, and so on. Okay. So this is a cycle. So there's an assumption here when people use this focus on cycles that there's a core group of policymakers at the centre of it, and they're making policy from the top down. So you consider, you know, this is a core group of elected politicians deciding how to make policy. So you imagine they start, notionally they start here at agenda settings. They say, what's the problem to which they're paying attention, and how would they sum it up? You know, so you've got sort of classic, you know, classic example. You know, what is poverty? You know, governments will decide if it's caused by, you know, major structural conditions within society that individuals can't overcome, or it's caused by, you know, the fecklessness of individuals who don't deserve government support. Now they'll decide that kind of thing. That kind of problem definition stage. Right? If they decide that governments should intervene, then they produce, they say, well, what's the best solution here? They'll select the best solution. Then they have to legitimise that solution in some way. So the kind of usual ways in which they do that would be legitimacy through permission from Parliament, or consultation with the public, or interest groups, or referendum, or so on. You know, they have to legitimise this process in some way. Then you say, well, let's implement that policy decision, then let's decide if it was a success or a failure, and then final stage, if it was a success, keep doing it, if it was a failure, do something else. So that's a kind of notional, ideal type of policy making. And these stages are, you know, you can see they're highly separable. Okay. Now the second is this idea of comprehensive rationality, which includes, you know, these conditions. You know, one is that policymakers have the ability to gather all information relevant to the decisions. So they've got an almost infinite capacity to consider every eventuality and the consequences of their actions. And they can do things like they can rank in a very clear order their preferences. So they know what they want to do and they know what choices they would make. So what we tend to do with comprehensive rationality is say, well, you know, policymakers are actually subject to bounded rationality, so they have to deal with the limitations to their ability to make choices and gather information. And most policy studies is based on that question of what happens when policymakers have to do that? Or you say, what actually happens instead of this policy cycle? Because almost all studies of policymaking, with a few exceptions, start off with this cycle to say this doesn't happen. Okay, so what happens instead? Okay. Now the problem, I think, for if you look at some studies of evidence-based policymaking outside of this literature, they look at things like the cycle and say, how can we engage in that process if this is how the policy process works? Okay. If there is a core group of decision makers going through this cycle, then we should be able to work out, you know, at what point we should inject scientific evidence. And then you might say, well, you know, let's try and get as close as possible to this comprehensive rationality ideal. That's what scientists are there for. If policymakers can't gather enough information, scientists and science will provide that information. Get as close to that ideal as possible. Okay, so, you know, so far, so good. Although I've said, I've given you a link there at that point in the blog post to say, you know, that sounds okay, I think, but it raises these questions about, you know, who should be privileged to provide that information. You know, because in this way of thinking, you're privileging a small group of scientists at the expense of almost any other provider of evidence. Right, so I guess we'll pick up that in both courses. You know, who should be providing this information? You know, whose evidence counts and whose doesn't? Okay. But what we'll focus on today is, you know, two insights that you can take from a departure from these two assumptions about the cycle and rationality. Now, the first, which kind of dominates policy studies, is that you identify the importance of multi-level policy-making environments or, you know, complex policy-making systems. And you tend to make reference to five factors or five properties of these systems. Okay. So the first is that they contain a much wider range of influential actors than the policy cycle idea would give you. You know, the cycle idea is a kind of small elite at the heart of government, whereas most studies identify a wide range of actors, which are individuals or organizations, inside and outside government, influencing policy at many levels of government. So we describe a, you know, highly complicated, complex process. So it's at that point that I like to make reference to something no one's ever heard of anymore, which is a spirograph. You need to be a certain age, I think, to remember spirograph, right? So it was this kind of child's plasticky thing that you used to make lots and lots of circles. Oh, I wonder if I could... Hang on, let me see if I can waste your time looking at this spirograph. Oh, there you go. That's not bad, right? So... You can, I mean, this is, imagine the only thing you take from this lecture is, oh, I'm going to go and get a spirograph, right? So, you know, imagine that sort of thing, where you're drawing, instead of there being one cycle at one level of government, you're drawing this huge, complicated interaction between lots of actors at lots of levels of government. Okay, there you go, spirograph. So you can go buy that, that's good. So, the second thing is that if you imagine there was only one place of decision making, it should be relatively easy to pick up what rules or norms they follow within those types of governments. It's not quite, because, you know, some of these rules are written down, like a constitution or a, you know, electoral method or, you know, things in legislation. But some things aren't written down, and you have to sort of follow what behaviour people follow. But if you're now saying that there are many levels of government, many organisations involved, then you're talking about, you know, again, this spirograph is good, but you're talking about this proliferation of rules followed by different people at different levels or types of government. And most policy theories are trying to capture the implications of that insight. The third thing we would point to is so-called policy networks or subsystems or communities. Now, these are often close relationships between policymakers who are, you know, elected, unelected policymakers, and the sort of powerful actors that help make decisions with them. And, you know, very briefly, you talk about there's a kind of logic of this relationship in terms of, you start with saying, well, the state is so large, you know, its responsibilities are so large that it's unmanageable by a small group of elected policymakers. Instead, what they do is they delegate almost all of those decisions to, you know, people in lower levels of government. And those people tend to be generalist civil servants. They rely on lots of interest groups and experts to help them make decisions. They form relationships based on trust, and you call those relationship networks. And to understand how policy is made, you have to understand the development of these networks. The fourth thing we would point to is a tendency for certain beliefs to dominate discussion. So there's lots of terms you might have come across to describe this dominance. So, you know, hegemonic ideas, paradigms, core beliefs, monopolies of ideas and such like. So these are the ideas or the language of policymaking which dominates to the extent that it's often taken for granted. So we're trying to pick up that kind of process as well. And finally, you would point to policy conditions or events or, you know, socioeconomic factors that can prompt policymakers to shift their attention at short notice. Well, they have to take these things into account to some extent. So, you know, sort of classics are, major demographic shifts or environmental events or real or invented crises within government and so on. So these are the five things that you would tend to point to and try to capture within policy studies or theories. Okay. Now, that's something you can follow up in a lot of the, you know, the posts I'll give you a reference to. But for now, you would say, well, how does that influence this image of evidence-based policymaking we're talking about? Now, the first is, we're saying, instead of having this single point of decision in which to inject evidence to a small group of policymakers, we're now saying, if you want to, you know, pursue evidence within policy, you have to influence a wide range of, you know, influential actors across government and multi-level government. Okay, and so it shows, you know, people providing evidence, you know, people like scientists, practitioners, they're competing with a huge number of actors to present particular evidence in a particular way to secure an audience at a particular time. Okay, and then you would say, well, support for particular forms of evidence or, you know, evidence-based solutions varies considerably according to the organisation that takes lead in any issue. So it's not necessarily central government. You know, these things are often decided, you know, at a supranational level or devolved or local level. Then you would say, you know, some of these networks we identify are close-knit and difficult to access because a lot of bureaucracies have particular operating procedures that favour some sources of evidence over others and some participants over others, and they use a language or a way of thinking that takes time to learn, and so it takes time to influence these processes with evidence because you have to find the right language. So, I mean, a classic phrase in good currency is value for money. You know, however effective or good an intervention is, it's a good way to demonstrate its value for money to policymakers. Okay. Then you might say, well, any new evidence you want to present will be interpreted through the lens of a dominant way of thinking within policy. Now, I think the extreme classics are, you know, imagine you came up with a really great, capitalist based solution to policy problems. There'll be no point in presenting, those, you know, during the height of the, you know, the communist or socialist period in Russia, right? Now, there's no point in presenting a great socialist solution in modern United States. You know, however you describe Obamacare as socialist, it's not, right? So it's, you know, there's no point in presenting some ideas in particular areas. So however evidence-based they are, if they don't fit with existing ways of thinking about policies or problems, they won't get particularly far. Okay. And finally, you might say that you know, maybe some socio-economic crises can prompt attention, you know, from one issue to another. You know, some forms of evidence can be used to encourage that shift. But you know, most policy studies suggest that it's very rare for that kind of process to prompt major changes in policy or policy making. You know, most policy studies identify huge amounts of continuity within systems and, you know, a small number of cases in which there are major departures from that. So that's the context in which you would consider the likely effect of new evidence, however dramatic. Okay. Now, the second insight you would talk about is that if policymakers are subject to bounded rationality, they use two shortcuts to make decisions. Now, you would say, I mean, these are not great descriptions, but you'd say one of those shortcuts is rational and one is irrational. Okay, so the rational one would be, you would say, well, they're still pursuing clear goals by prioritizing certain kinds of information and sources of information. So they can still be, you know, rational in that sense by saying, well, we'll trust expertise and we'll base our decisions on, you know, a hierarchy of evidence. But then you would say the second shortcut they use to make very quick decisions is they draw on, you know, things like their emotions, their gut feelings, their deeply held beliefs, their habits, and the things they find familiar. Okay, so, you know, part of that is about a kind of a quick emotional discussion or a quick emotional shortcut that policymakers to characterize particular populations. For example, you know, who is deserving of their punishment or their benefits, for example. They also base decisions on how easily they can process information. So there's a kind of, there's a literature in psychology about fluency. It suggests, you know, that people value information more if it's familiar to them, if they can process it easily, if they can understand it. Okay, so if that is the case, then our focus in terms of the production of evidence is not so much in how you know, simplify it to make it to understand. It's about how you frame the information to help portray or categorize issues. Okay. So most policymaking agenda setting is about framing, manipulation, making emotional appeals to gather attention, such like. So, I mean, two examples I go into more in some of these links. If you look at the history of tobacco control, policymakers were much more likely to do something about it, you know, to introduce the comprehensive levels of control you have now, if they see it primarily as a public health epidemic. You know, if you can convince policymakers that there's a crisis or an epidemic to solve, this makes them more likely to accept solutions like, you know, bans on smoking in public places. But traditionally, they saw it primarily as something that was good for the economy. It was at one point in the UK's history, there was a government minister that pretty much said smokers are funding the welfare state. Okay, you know, tobacco accounted for 15% of tax revenue in the UK, and it was paying for the NHS and other services. You know, and it was providing, you know, lots of jobs and exports and such like. Now, so in that context, it's very difficult to persuade policymakers to introduce controls to reduce smoking in the population. But now they see it primarily as a public health epidemic, you know, something else. Now, it's the same with other issues like, you know, hydraulic fracturing for shale, oil and gas, or fracking. You know, how policymakers respond to these issues depends very much on if they see it primarily as, you know, a source of a new energy boom, or you know, a great source of energy security, or they see it as an environmental disaster. You know, the injection of scientific evidence will depend very much on how they initially view this. You know, it'll influence how much they demand information on these particular things. Okay, so those kinds of insights help us think through, you know, what people like scientists would have to do if they wanted their evidence to be influential within government. So give me some links to some studies that follow up this kind of idea. So, you know, so one is that they will have to combine, you know, their facts or evidence with emotional appeals, because they want to prompt these lurches of policymaker attention from one understanding of policy to another. So they combine facts and emotions. So you would see a lot of that in a discussion of punctuated equilibrium theory. Then you might say, well, what they need to do is turn a huge amount of complicated information into these incredibly simple stories which are easy to understand. So you help manipulate people's emotions or biases by, say, giving you simple stories which apportion praise and blame to particular individuals or groups, and they highlight the immediate moral and political value of solutions. So, yeah, so there's a literature called the, you know, the narrative policy framework that goes into examples of people telling these simple stories. And it might be that no matter how much of an expert you are as a scientist, you're competing badly with people with far less information if they're able to tell a simple story that people can understand and respond to. Then there's a literature associated with the advocacy coalition framework that says, you know, to pursue particular forms of evidence, you have to consider how it will be interpreted through the lens of pre-existing beliefs. So they describe the political systems or subsystems in which these coalitions of actors compete with each other to say what the implications of the evidence are, and, you know, how influential it should be. And as a final relevant literature, you know, it's called multiple streams analysis. And it talks about, you know, if you've provided an evidence-based policy solution that's technically feasible, you know, it'll work as intended if you introduce it. They still have to find a time to adopt it. They have to find a time when policymakers have the motive and opportunity to adopt that solution. And that motive and opportunity to listen to new evidence and solutions is more important than the evidence itself. Yes, so to try and understand that process, you wouldn't start with the evidence provided by scientists. You would look at how receptive policymakers are to considering the issues they're talking about. Okay. So consider the implications, two implications of that kind of discussion. The first is that it's important to note that a lot of these concepts we talk about are there to describe what doesn't happen. So if you read up on policy cycles, comprehensive rationality, they're there largely or almost exclusively to help you consider what happens when these things don't happen. You know, what are the real-world implications of the limits to these models? They're not there to help you, you know, make decisions or pursue strategies to inject evidence into that process. And the second thing is, you know, because of that, these initial models don't help you give good advice to people trying to influence the policy process. So I think, I mean, there's two different aspects to that. I've had discussions with civil servants in the past, for example, and we go through that. We start off with a cycle, and then we consider these more realistic models. Now it's more tricky with policymakers in that position. Because you can still conclude at the end of it that what you should be doing is gathering as much evidence as possible and going through this process of stages. So if we go back to the CAM, go back to the cycle, it's still legitimate for, say, an elected policymaker or a civil servant to think, well, I understand all this, these complications of the post process, but it still makes sense to go through these stages. And I think it does, right? They still want to think to themselves, well, first I'll work out the problem is, then the best solution, then I'll legitimate what we do, then implement and evaluate. It still makes sense to talk about that in terms of what policymakers should do. But that's very difficult from giving people advice, interest groups or advocates of evidence, giving them advice about how they should try and influence the process. Because, they'll find that, however much people want to engage in that sort of ordered stage-based process, it won't happen. Okay, so finally, the third point, this is quicker than I expected. I was kind of expecting everyone to kind of be, there's a point at which you can't listen anymore, I reckon. I think it's about 15 minutes, so I'm assuming, oh, there you go, you are listening notionally, right? So I was going to keep this third bit short, which is to kind of introduce a kind of more practical side to this, which I don't know, it would come up in some of your courses. I think there's a big difference between generating these insights and knowing what to advise to give to people on that basis. So let me give you two examples. Imagine you accept that the policy processes are incredibly complex and multi-level. Now what you're saying to people is that you cannot be influential if you choose a single point in time or a single place to make your case and provide evidence. So instead what you have to do is work out what the policy terrain is and at what level people make decisions. Spend some time trying to understand the rules they follow when they're making decisions, and some of those rules won't be written down, so that will take some time. Form close relationships with civil servants based on trust, in which you exchange information. Form coalitions with other actors. Work out what the currency or the best language to use when you're presenting information, and seek opportunities to present issues when there are sudden lurches of attention based on socioeconomic crises. Now, what I've described there is a kind of lifetime of pursuing a strategy to be influential, and almost no one has the time or the resources to do that. Okay, so that's the first problem with providing advice based on that information. You've got these new insights about how complicated the policy process is, how long it might take to influence it, but no real good advice about what you should tell people, apart from invest 3 decades of your life to influence the policy process. Now, there's a similar but more kind of ethical consideration based on the second piece of advice. The second piece of advice is if policymakers can only consider so much information, they're only willing to process so much information if it's familiar, they base their decisions on very quick moral and emotional judgments, then it seems that the best way to influence policy with evidence is to be incredibly manipulative. So scientists, I think, are characterized by the presentation of information equivocally. They'll say, well, here's the best evidence just now, but don't go too far with it. It only tells us so much, and we need to produce more research. Now, the advice, I think, on these insights for scientists or other advocates is forget all that talk of being equivocal. Simply say this is the best evidence, and if you don't do anything with it, there'll be a huge crisis. You exploit their emotional biases, manipulate information, provide very simple stories that exclude most information, and so on. And you can see that there are sort of practical and ethical issues there about how people should behave. And also what the consequences are. You know, if you develop a reputation as someone who goes well ahead of the evidence, you know, it might be that you can only be successful once or twice. Okay. So, that only took 30 minutes. I guess this means, well, where did Peter go?
I think he's in a phone call outside.
Oh, he's gone? Right, okay. Right, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to... I could say something mean about Peter when he's not here. Oh, no, I'll tell you what, that's 40 minutes. Yeah, 40.